Bibles to the 14th chapter of Luke. Luke chapter 14. Luke chapter 14 comes as Jesus is finishing Galilean ministry, and he's now on his way to Jerusalem to die. Chapter 9 and verse 51 of Luke said he set his face steadfastly, or like flint, as he was journeying on the way to Jerusalem. Because so much of the gospel is preoccupied with the death of Jesus, it's easy to forget just how popular this man really was during his lifetime. There were times when he was in town speaking where the crowd was so great that if they were going to get a person in need to him, they had to break through a roof and lower a man down in front of him. There were times on the Galilean seashore where there was such a huge crowd listening to him that he ran out of shoreline and he had to put himself out in a boat in order to continue speaking to the people. And there was times where rich men would crawl up trees because they were too short to see him in a large crowd. They wanted to get a look at this man. That's just how popular he was. And you would think that on his way to Jerusalem, facing the most difficult time of his life, he knew what was coming. He knew what to expect. That he would want as many people around him as possible, as many people to support him as possible. And he's riding, at this time, the very crest of his popularity. And it would seem like that in order to get that company around him, he'd want to tone down his message just a little bit. Make it a little less serious. Make it a little bit more compromising and appealing. But it seems like as the time progresses to where he's getting closer to Jerusalem, he gets more serious with the crowds and more demanding in terms of what it takes to follow him. He does it in chapter 11 with the crowd there in verse 29. He does it in chapter 12 in the first two verses. And he does it here again in chapter 14 in verse 25. When he sees a large crowd following him, it's like he almost turns around and discourages people from doing it. Chapter 14 in verse 25 says, "Large crowds were traveling with Jesus, and turning to them he said," and then follows some of the toughest words about what it takes to be his disciple that he'd ever spoken. Now the theme of this chapter is what it really takes to be a disciple. That's mentioned in verse 26. It's mentioned again in verse 27 and again in verse 33. There are certain things, he says, that must happen in a person's life or he cannot be my disciple. Now, the name Christian has been cherished by people through the centuries. But that name didn't come into existence until many years after Christ had lived and died, was buried and raised again. As a matter of fact, it wasn't used at all during his ministry with people. He didn't call people to become Christians. He called people to become disciples. And the first time this word is used, we find in the 11th chapter of Acts in verse 26, when it says there, after Paul and Barnabas had spent 1 year there talking to people and reasoning with them about the way of Christ, it says that the disciples were called Christians first in Antioch. Now, why were they called? Why did people start calling these people Christians? They never were called Christians before. They were called disciples. Disciples of Christ. Well, I think it's because of the change in their lives. I think there was an unmistakable identification that people were making with the life of Christ and with the lives of these people they were seeing. They took knowledge of them that they'd been with Jesus, Luke says, in chapter 4 of the book of Acts. People were taking knowledge, taking account of the fact that these people walked with Jesus, that they'd been with Jesus. As a matter of fact, they could see in their lives the fact that these people had met the demands that Jesus had laid out here for being His disciple. And so, being Christ-like, they started calling these disciples Christian. And the only way that people will really be Christian, that is Christ-like again, is if we insist on Jesus' way. And that is to make disciples. And then people will see the disciples and will call them Christ-like or Christian. As your outline indicates there, in your introduction, one cannot be a Christian unless he's willing to become a disciple. Now, what is it Jesus demanded of one who wanted to become a Christian or a disciple? Well, in this passage in Luke 14, I can see three things that he demanded of a person. Number one is he demanded an unrivaled love. An unrivaled love. Look at verse 26. If anyone comes to me and does not hate his father and mother, his wife and children, his brothers and sisters, yes, even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. I never will forget the first time I read those words. I was just absolutely shocked. Now, what does he mean? You can run through a lot of commentaries and they can say, oh, Jesus didn't mean actually hate. What he meant was loved less. And then they run the different sections of the Bible to point that out. But you know, whenever commentators or whenever people tend to come to those times in Jesus' life where his language really got rough, there's always a tendency, an immediate tendency, to tone that down, to make that more digestible. And I've seen people take an awful lot of liberties with the text and with the terms that Jesus Christ laid down. It almost feels like that. It's almost like that people just feel free to negotiate the terms upon which Jesus would call people. And so Jesus, in many cases, has become a kind of a projection of our human sentiment. He's not the real Jesus that the gospel presents. He's just the Jesus that we wish him to be. The unspoken implication many times when people are extended the invitation to follow Jesus is, just sign right here, it won't hurt a bit. You'll only be required to show up occasionally, to make a token appearance or two. And we don't talk about stewardship much around here. So don't worry about it. Jesus will meet all your needs. I don't think we're ever going to get to the real meaning and intention of the words of Jesus with an attitude like that. So what does hate mean? When he says, if a person comes to me, he must hate his father and mother, his wife and children, what does that mean? The only way I know how to solve that and to see, get exactly what he's meaning here is to look at Jesus Christ's example. That's A on your outline under Roman numeral 1. To look at his example. Did he desert his family? Was he criminally negligent and abusive of children? Is that what he means, to detest people, to hate people? If you look at his life in chapter 2 of Luke and verse 51, it says that he went home with his parents and was obedient to them. And the indication there was that was his style of life. He was obedient to his parents. In chapter 7 of the Gospel of Mark, verses 10 and 11, he took on the teachers of the law and the Pharisees in the harshest of terms, saying that you say that you can put aside your obligation to your mother and father and not honor your mother and father if you just give this gift of Korban to the temple of God. He condemned that in the harshest terms. In chapter 10, verse 13 of the Gospel of Mark, he became irate and indignant when his disciples were pushing the children away. And he says, let the children come to me. This is what the kingdom is all about. This is what the kingdom is made of, is children. And it says he took them in his arms and he blessed them again and again fervently. And in chapter 19 of the Gospel of John, in verse 26, there he is hanging on the cross in agony. And he looks down and he sees his mother there. And he wants to be sure that his mother is taken care of before he draws his last breath. So he entrusts her to the care of John, Now that's Jesus on the one hand. But on the other hand, this word that he uses for hate here in Luke 14 is the same word that is used in chapter 6 of Luke and verse 22 when it says there, "Blessed are you when men hate you, when they exclude you and abuse you on account of my name." It's the same word there. Now Jesus used hyperbole often to shock people. And that's exactly what it does. When I look at this, it shocks me. Because the kind of allegiance and the kind of loyalty that he's demanding here must be so far above any other kind of allegiance and loyalty that I have in life that the term hate is used. What about the side of his life in Mark chapter 3 and verse 31 where he's sitting there teaching some disciples and his mother and brothers come and say, "Jesus, your mothers and brothers are outside and they're looking for you. They want to see you. So you'll need to leave whatever you're doing here and obviously go out there because that's your mother and brothers." He said, "Who are my mother and my brothers and my sisters? Those who do God's will are my mother and my brother and my sisters." And he stays right there and goes on teaching. Or in John chapter 7, verses 3 through 5, his brothers come to him and said, "Well, look, Jesus, obviously if you're going to make yourself known and a public figure, you need to get out in public and do things the way things are supposed to be done." He says, "Well, you guys go on down to Jerusalem. You don't understand what's going on here." But in John 7, it says even his brothers didn't believe in him. His own brothers did not believe or understand him. And these words that Jesus spoke here in Luke 14 are not original with him. Jesus grew up with the Torah. And he cut his teeth on Deuteronomy chapter 13 and verses 6 through 11. Let me read that to you. It says, "If your very own brother or your son or your daughter or the wife you love or your closest friend secretly entices you saying, 'Let's go and worship another God, gods that neither you or your fathers have known,' do not yield to him or listen to him. Show him no pity. Do not spare him or shield him. You must certainly put him to death. Your hand must be the first in putting him to death, and then the hands of all the people. Stone him to death." Now, the law says that's your brother, your son, your daughter, or your wife. Now, Israel didn't listen to that. It was not practiced by Israel. And as a result, that nation was undone and destroyed by idolatry. Now, the way I think we modify those words sometimes is we say, "Well, let's make Jesus a meaningful part of your life," or "love Jesus first and your family second." But see, that doesn't say it the way he did. Jesus doesn't take a number. "I'm number one, this is number two, number three," and so forth. Jesus Christ says that he's your life. All of your life. Your total life. And to say it as strong as he did, we can't modify it by saying number one, number two, and number three. Now, here's what that means. Jesus is saying sometimes the higher duty to me is going to conflict with the duty to your parents, just like it did in my life, Jesus is saying. So the point is, what are you going to do when that happens? And you say, "Well, Ben, how do you know when that happens? How do you know when your affections and your concern and your genuine concern and your love for your parents or your son or your daughter or whatever that might be, how do you know when that's conflicting? How do you know that?" I can't answer that for you. I know that God will give you wisdom, just like He gave His own Son, Jesus. And I know there are some situations where I can't tell you which is... I said in a counseling session one time, which I interrupted, when a person was sitting there deciding to become a Christian, And this person was sitting across the table from him. And that person asked the same question. He said, how do I know when this is when these two things are conflicting? How do I know when my duty to God is conflicting with my duty to my parents or my duty to my family? How will I know that? And that young man just said, well, whenever there's a conflict between church and family, that means you always choose the church. And I said, whoa, wait a minute. It ain't that simple. It's just not that simple. God says that He will give you wisdom. But it's not that black and white. The most important point here is that my primary aim is to please my God. I am to love Him with all my heart, with all my soul, with all my strength, and with all my mind. Does that leave anything? That doesn't leave anything. But be on your outline, when the family becomes the ultimate concern and consideration, then it has become an idol. Family can become an idol. I have seen people at sometimes being pointed out a clear commandment from God's Word. Very clear commandment that is going to have its consequences and implications with the family. And you know how a person answers that? They say, well, Ben, you don't understand. That'll upset my wife. My mother won't understand. That may cost me my girlfriend. And that's the point when you say, well, if that is your primary consideration, and whether or not you're going to do the will of God, if that's your ultimate concern, then He says, you cannot be my disciple. Because it just won't work. Sometimes those two things are going to clash. Sometimes we'll be in agony over those things trying to decide. God will give us wisdom. He will give us strength. But those cannot be. My loyalty to my daughter, my son, my wife cannot be in any way subordinate to my loyalty to my Father. Now, what was going to happen to my family as a result of that? Jesus said, if you try to save your family, you'll lose it. But if you lose your family for my sake and for the gospel, you'll find it. Do you know that I can't be the kind of father that I need to be to my children? The kind of father that they need to have unless I love the Lord my God with all my heart, with all my soul, with all my mind, and with all my strength. The second thing that Jesus said here is in verse 27. The second thing that He demanded was an unceasing dying. An unceasing dying. He says, and anyone, verse 27, who does not carry his cross and follow me cannot be my disciple. Now, you know, when I first saw those words, I thought, carry my cross, what does that mean? Well, it means put this big burden up on my back and remain stooped over the rest of my life spiritually. And some people have turned that cross into anything from lumbago and arthritis. You know, that's my cross I need to bear. You know, to a cranky father-in-law or mother-in-law or, you know, anything like that. That's my cross to bear in life. That's not what Jesus is talking about when He says, carry your cross and follow me. Because where is He going? He's going to the place of execution. That's where He's going. And when He carries His cross, He's going to carry it up. He's going to put the cross beam on His back, take it to a place. It's going to be placed down there. He's going to be put on it, nailed to it, and erected. Now, what He's talking about here is dying, an unceasing dying, a lifestyle of dying, which He'd done all of His life and which He will culminate in the cross of Jesus Christ. The thing that I've tried to do in the last few years is to reconcile the self-acceptance that Christ talks about with His self-crucifixion. That's A on your outline, 2A. How does the need for a healthy self-esteem relate to the call of Jesus to put self to death? Psychologists are rightly concerned about desiring to implant in us a sense of true self-worth and a sense of true self-appreciation. And that is right and it's good. But you know there's a very quick step from inferiority in inadequacy. It's a very quick step from there up to egotism and willful pride and rebellion. I know because I took that step. I went from that feeling of inferiority and inadequacy, and I flip-flopped clear to the other side of snobbery and self-righteousness and pride. Still fight those things in my life. And you know, it's that thing in us that perverts our personalities and tends to distort and twist our perspective and our thinking. The Bible calls that sin. It's not an isolated act. It's something that's working in us. It's a power that's working in us that tends to distort and twist our personalities. And that thing cannot be removed by some kind of easy operation or by some kind of self-help course. The only way that can be removed is by the death, the burial, and the resurrection of Jesus Christ, His victory over sin. And Jesus calls us to participate in that. And B on your outline, we share in His death initially in baptism and perpetually in service to others. Initially, we're crucified with Christ in baptism. We enter into His death, His burial, and His resurrection. And then we're raised from that point on to give our lives in service to others. He died for all so that those who live should no longer live for themselves, but for Him who died for them and was raised again. Paul said in 2 Corinthians 5 and verse 14 and 15. Paul said in 1 Corinthians 15 verse 31, he says, "Brethren, I die daily." I mean that, brothers. I die daily. And Luke earlier in his gospel in chapter 9 verse 33, "If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me." It's a lifestyle that we adopt. You know, sometimes I think if Jesus were standing in the back and prospective new member came in, and that person were to say, "Well, what does this church have to offer me?" And Jesus might likely say something like, "Well, a class without a teacher and a few new Christians to help nurture and be hospitable to." Or a person comes in, "I don't feel welcomed and loved here." "Well, you stand right over here," Jesus might say, "and make sure the next visitor does." Or, "I never get invited over. Nobody invites me out." And Jesus might say, "Why don't you go out into the highways and the byways?" That's what He said earlier in this chapter. "Invite in the lame and the blind, those who can't repay you. You'll be repaid in the resurrection." See, what He's trying to say to us, if you want to follow Me, self-centeredness and self at the center of your life has to die. Anyone who does not carry his cross and follow Me cannot be My disciple. And thirdly, verse 33, He talks about an unqualified renunciation. Look at verse 33. "In the same way, any of you who does not give up everything he has cannot be My disciple." You know, the most frequent topic in the Gospel of Luke is the misuse of possessions. There's more material in Luke on that subject than any other subject in the Gospel. Look under A, and let's look down through some of these. chapter 6 and verse 21, Jesus said, If your use of your possessions is strictly for personal pleasure, you cannot be my disciple. As a matter of fact, he says, woe to you who are rich now, for you have received your comfort. Woe to you who are well fed now, for you'll go hungry. Woe to you who laugh now, for you will weep and mourn. Woe to you when all men speak well of you, for that's how their fathers treated the false prophets. Now, he's not pronouncing a curse on anybody who's rich and anybody who can feed themselves well. But what he's saying is there are haves and have-nots in our society. And if you're not in some way identified with the have-nots, and giving what God has so richly blessed you with, dispersing some of that and sharing some of that, you cannot be my disciple. Or look at chapter 12 and verse 16. There he gets into our retirement programs with the rich young fool, or with the rich fool. This rich fool had accumulated much through investment after investment. He got a lot of real estate. He bought a lot of fields. He put a lot of things in the barn. And he thought to himself, what am I going to do with all this that I've got, all this abundance and all this provision? Well, I think I'll just build me a bigger barn. I'll get me a bigger tax shelter. I'll get me a bigger IRA, a bigger annuity, and I'll throw it all in there. And then when the time comes for retirement, I'll just draw on it. And I'll get me a cabin here and a condominium there. And we'll go fishing and we'll just spend the rest of our lives, eat, drink, and be merry. And Jesus said, oh, what a wonderful retirement program. No. He said, you fool. This night your life will be required of you. And then what do you have to show for all this you've got? It's a fool's plan for retirement if one wants to be a disciple of Jesus Christ. Or in chapter 14, just earlier here, look at the banquet that's been prepared. Here, Jesus pictures God as a king who's invited everybody to his banquet. He's so joyous. Everybody's already been invited. See, and these people have already accepted the invitation. They're already in. And then he sends his servant out and says, come on now, everything's ready. And look at what they say. Verse 18. They all begin to make excuses. The first said, I just bought a field. I got to go and see about it. Please excuse me. And still another said, I just got married. I can't come. And another said, I just bought five yoke of oxen. I've got to go try them out. You'll just have to excuse me. I can't come. They're so preoccupied and wrapped up with material interest that spiritual matters have to take second place. And then fourthly, the failure to respond to others' needs. Luke 16, the rich man Lazarus, and Luke 18, the rich young ruler. They're just so attached to their possessions that they just can't part with them. They can't share them and give them away. You know, I think when a person is counting the cost about following Jesus, he ought to count the cost about not following Jesus. He ought to look at what happens if you don't, the alternative, if you don't go this way. And boy, have I found this so true with possessions. There is a constant pressure on me. It's around me, it's on the radio, it's on television, it's in advertising. There's a constant pressure on me to consume, 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 and just remain dissatisfied constantly with what I have. The advertisers have set it up so that you're supposed to be dissatisfied with what you have. And so the mind gets constantly preoccupied with what I don't have, what I don't have, what I still need. And luxuries become necessities. And Jesus talked about the kind of anxiety that can create in a person's life in the sixth chapter of Luke. He said, just like the Gentiles and the pagans constantly running after these things. You're on a treadmill, this bill to pay, this matter to see about. And the life is just eaten up with that kind of thing. And there's hardly enough time to just get off the treadmill sometimes and say, what is all this for? All this, all these things I'm surrounded with. What are they for? That's all Jesus is trying to get us to see. What in the world are they for? And He said, let me tell you what they're for. They're for sharing. That kind of thing. And there's hardly enough time to just to get off the treadmill sometimes and say, what is all this for? All these things I'm surrounded with. What are they for? That's all Jesus is trying to get us to see. What in the world are they for? And He said, let me tell you what they're for. They're for sharing. And if you don't share them, they'll become your God and they'll strangle your life. They'll eat you up with anxiety and worry. And that seal on your island, the only way to renounce possessions as a tyrannous God is to share them. Now, Jesus tells two parables in the midst of this, beginning in verse 31. Two parables to illustrate these three demands. An unrivaled love. An unqualified renunciation. And He says in this parable, suppose one of you wants to build a tower. Verse 28. Will he not first sit down and estimate the cost, see if he has enough money to complete it? For if he lays the foundation and is not able to finish it, everyone who sees it will ridicule him, saying, this fellow began to build and was not able to finish. Or suppose a king is about to go to war against another king. Will he not first sit down and consider whether he is able, with 10,000 men, to oppose the one coming against him with 20,000? If he's not able, he'll send a delegation while the other is still a long way off and ask for terms of peace. Two parables to illustrate our point. The traditional interpretation of these parables, that's A under number 4, is that what Jesus is doing here is warning us against half-heartedness, following Him merely out of convenience or curiosity. Or He's warning us about a thoughtless entry into this matter of discipleship, you know. He's saying, you sit down here and you count the cost. Do you have the means that it takes to complete this course, this way of life? And so that requires, thirdly, a very intensive self kind of scrutiny. Is your heart really in it? Do you mean business? Well, I think that there is some teaching in this section on that, but I'm not so sure, after some recent study, I'm not so sure that that's what these parables are driving at. I'm not so sure that what He's directing His attention to is the person who's considering these demands and telling him, sit down and count the cost, see if he's able to complete it. Let me tell you why. Let me share with you a couple of problems that I see with that. Number one, and that's B, is the response to Jesus Christ doesn't grow out of calculation, it grows out of faith. The main response to Jesus Christ grows out of faith and not out of calculation. When people were stumbling at looking at the cost of it, like the man in Mark chapter 10, Jesus says, what do you mean, if I can? All things are possible to him who believes. Nothing is impossible, he says, to you, if you believe. Now, nothing is impossible to you is a matter of faith, not a matter of calculation. And when you go through the Gospel of Luke, when you see Jesus doing miracles or healings or dealing with this matter of salvation, what he demanded from people, ultimately from them, was faith. Trust in Him and not calculation. I've gotten the impression over the few years, and it used to be with me, that the most important thing in a person's salvation is the seriousness or intensity with which he makes the commitment. And I'm not so sure that that's what Jesus is saying here. Because I'm not called to trust in my projected strength, ever how much I can project out there in the future to see how much strength that I have to keep my commitment. I'm called to trust in Jesus Christ. And I'm called to believe that looking at His life, that all things can be possible through Him. And when I look at my attachment to possessions, my attachments to family, and I'm wanting to hold on to those things because I'm so used to holding on to them, they've been my security. They've been the foundation of my life, all my life. Boy, I've got to have a reason to let go of those things. And the reason can't be that I'm projecting I have this much resources and this much strength to carry through with this commitment. The reason has got to be that I've seen Jesus Christ and I can trust Him with those things. I visited up in Washington not too long ago, and there was a young man up there who had just become a Christian. He was laying in a hospital, and he was suspended in midair in this tank kind of thing. It was keeping him absolutely still because, you see, he took his family on a Hawaiian vacation, had a very successful business, 3 small boys. He and his wife just became Christians, and he went body surfing. And as they were coming in, that wave just picked him up and just drove his head first right down in the sand, just severed his spinal cord. He was absolutely paralyzed from the neck down. When some of the members came to visit him and he got the news, you know, that he was going to be paralyzed, he just wept and cried. He was so angry. Just helplessly watching those 3 little boys as they brought him in to visit with him. Couldn't bring those boys up on his lap anymore. Couldn't love his wife the way he wanted to. His business would be gone. Couldn't participate in that anymore. The minister who taught him, he and I are good friends and we trained together at Memphis State. The minister who taught him came in and said, you know, he said, I sat there just silent and all that suffering. And he turned to me, he had tears in his eyes. He said, you know, when you studied with me, we sat down, we counted the cost, you know, about becoming a Christian. But he says, no way in the world could I have anticipated this happening to me. But he said, the one thing you kept saying in our study that's, I think it's going to pull me through this, is that whatever happens, you can trust Jesus. You can trust God. And he said, I found him, as we studied in the Gospels, to be a person that I could trust. No matter what happened, family, possessions, or anything, I could trust him. You know, we cannot leave people with the unspoken assumption that you can begin the Christian life only when you absolutely believe it's within your power to complete it. Because under your outline there, how would you know that you have sufficient resources to justify commencing the Christian life? The most important thing to understand is you can trust Jesus Christ. And if He asks this from you with your family, with your possessions, yea, even with your own life, you can trust Him. Well, what is the interpretation of these parables then? What would be the interpretation? Well, this is kind of new to me, looking at the parables this way, but let me suggest this to you. You study it, you see what you think. Could Jesus be telling this parable, these 2 parables, from His own viewpoint? And that's C on your outline. That is, here as He is, He says, He's made these demands, and you can just see Him. He's made these demands to these people, and you can just see their eyeballs are wide open, and their chins have dropped on the ground. And He just looks at them, and He says, well, suppose one of you wants to build a tower. Wouldn't you first sit down and count the cost? to see if you have the means to complete it? In other words, Jesus is saying, here I am, I'm going to Jerusalem. I'm going to die. I'm laying the foundations for the Messianic kingdom here. And I need frontline troops to build this thing, to carry this thing off. And if I do it another way, it won't work. If I'm going to take 10,000 and go against 20,000, as the odds were, then I got to have those 10,000 totally sold out to me. Trust me. And so I need people in my ranks that are that committed to me. Because I've got something to do. I've got something to build. I've got a war to wage. I've counted the cost. And this I know is what it's going to take. I've not only counted the cost, Jesus said, I've paid the cost. As we already saw, He paid the cost with His family. And back in Luke 9, He was the one that says, foxes have holes and birds have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay His head. He was totally detached from possessions. He'd given it all to the building of this kingdom. And He owned it all. He was the owner of it all. And yea, even His own life. And you know, He often sought to explain God by reference to human action. Look at chapter 15, same construction, verse 4 of Luke. He says, suppose one of you has 100 sheep and loses one of them. Just like in verse 31. Suppose one of, or verse 28 of chapter 14, suppose one of you wants to build a tower. He's about to talk to them, not just about them, but about God. And He often did that by attributing human actions to God. Suppose one of you wants to has 100 sheep and loses one of them. Suppose one of you has a son who comes to him and says, I need that, I need some bread. Would you give him a stone? Or suppose one of you had a child that came to you and wanted an egg. Would you give him a scorpion or a snake? So I think he's talking here not just maybe about himself, but about God. God is often seen in the Old Testament as the builder of things. Especially towers. Towers was often associated with the city of Jerusalem, directly associated in the Old Testament. God is the builder of all things. Only He has the strength to complete anything. And if a man has any strength to complete something, it's only because God gives him the strength to do it. And so, Jesus might be saying again with this parable, look, God has started building this thing. Don't you think He's counted the cost? Don't you think He knows what He's doing? Don't you think He's calculated this thing so He knows He's going to win the war? God knows what He's doing. Well, that's a new slant of those parables. Maybe you've never looked at it that way before. And I hadn't either until recently, but consider that. Think about it. You know, I've met so many people who feel bored with life, unchallenged, always looking for excitement, some adventure, feel like that their life has just become so mundane that it's so much in a rut. I can't think of anything more challenging and more exciting and in a sense more adventuresome and more threatening and more risk-taking than to take these words of Jesus Christ seriously. And I'd like to ask you some questions this morning. Is there anything in your life that's worth everything you've got? I mean everything. Your life, your possessions, everything. Because the choice is not really whether I'm going to invest my life, it's just what I'm going to invest it in. What are you investing your life in this morning? Is it worth it? Is it worth your family? Is it worth your possessions? Is it worth, yea, even your very self? Is it worth it? What kind of return are you getting on your investment? Everybody gets a return on their investment. What are you getting from your investment? Oh, I know people have these theoretical principles. Oh, I'm giving my life to this, and I'm giving my life to this. But when you look at the checkbook, and when you look at the amount of time that's spent, when you look at where the energies go, that will tell you where your life is going. So what are you investing your life in? And is what you're currently giving your life to, is it worthy of your life? Is it worthy? And Jesus said, unless you give it all to me, you cannot be my disciple. Is he worth it? What kind of return would you get on that investment? Have you ever looked at his life? Have you ever looked at the lives of those who have really given it all to him? Is it worth it? I really think you'll find that it is. This morning, while we sing this invitation song, I'd like for you to consider these words and ask yourself, is what I'm currently giving my life to really worth it? While we stand and sing.